Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Our focus this week is on Benjamin Franklin, one of the most beloved and influential of the nation's founding fathers. Talking History's Fred Nielsen will be talking with Edmund Morgan about his new biography of Franklin. And after that, filmmaker Ronald Blumer will join us to explain some of the techniques he used in his television documentary on Franklin to bring this figure to life for his viewers. But first, Joey Skidmore once again takes a look at an important event that occurred this week in history.
This week in history, on June 16, 1966, the Miranda rights were established by a Supreme Court decision in Miranda v. Arizona. The case arose when Ernest Miranda was arrested and charged with sexual assault. He was interrogated, and he made a confession, which he later recanted, but he was nevertheless convicted. The American Civil Liberties Union assisted Miranda on appeal, their attorneys arguing that the police failed to tell him that he had the right not to answer the police officer's questions. The Supreme Court agreed, ruling that thereafter the police were to inform suspects in custody of their rights with the following now well-known lines. You have the right to remain silent. Anything you say can and will be used against you in a court of law. You have the right to consult with an attorney, and or to have one present when questioned by the police. If you cannot afford an attorney, one will be appointed to represent you. Ernest Miranda was retried and convicted in October 1966. He was released from prison in 1972, but died in a bar fight 4 years later.
In some ways, Benjamin Franklin was a man of contradictions. He was a leading patriot in America's war for independence, but for many years he considered himself a British subject. He did as much as anyone to shape the world in which he lived, but that world was not quite what he would have preferred. Fred Nielsen helps us sort out these matters and explores other areas of Franklin's life with his guest, Edmund Morgan.
Edmund S. Morgan is one of America's most distinguished historians. Few, if any, have added more to our understanding of the colonial era and the Revolution. In his now classic book, American Slavery, American Freedom, Morgan explored the roots of the central paradox of the nation's history. Edmund Morgan is Sterling Professor of History Emeritus at Yale University. His most recent book, the subject of our discussion today, is a biography of Benjamin Franklin. Professor Morgan, welcome.
Hi, how are you?
Just fine, thanks. We live in a time when even people who lived short lives become subjects of very long biographies. Your book about Franklin was, and this is your phrase, purposely short. What was your purpose in being brief?
Well, there are plenty of very good biographies of Franklin, as there are of all our founding fathers, that give you all the details available about their lives. But in writing about famous men, it seems to me that what a reader might wish to know is, what does the author make of this man? And I can explain what I make of Franklin in 300 pages. If I can't do it in that length of time, I'll never be able to.
Franklin, along the way, has acquired a reputation as someone who advocated hard work and frugality primarily as a way to wealth. In fact, how important was it for him to be rich? Was that his purpose?
It's easy to answer that question. It wasn't important at all. He was not interested in becoming rich, and indeed, he thought that it would be advisable for the government to discourage the accumulation of wealth in a small number of hands. He would have been very distressed at the kind of plutocracy we have now, I think.
He seems to have had no interest in religious arguments, which is interesting for someone who was born in Puritan Massachusetts. He ends up a very tolerant man religiously. What was the source of that tolerance, and what were his religious views? Did he express them?
It was easy for him to be tolerant because he didn't care much about religion. got a full dose of Puritan theology in Boston when he lived there, was growing up there. But he soon discovered that arguing against theology was a worthless effort. He had, at the beginning, an attempt to disprove the kind of theology that existed in Boston and to help out a minister in Philadelphia who was under attack for his religious views. But that's the last time he ventured into theology, because theological propositions were not susceptible to proof, and it wasn't much use talking about them. So his own religion was a kind of deism, a belief that God existed. If he didn't exist, where did all the world and its creatures come from? But he wasn't really very much interested in it. He thought that the best way, mode of worship, was simply to do good to your fellow man and let it go at that. He wasn't interested in theology.
In fact, as you point out in your book, one of his primary concerns, far more than worrying about religion, far more than being rich, is to be useful to his fellow man. That becomes, if anything, his guiding purpose in life.
Absolutely. Being useful, it overcame everything else. And when he founded the American Philosophical Society, it had the name of the Society for Promoting Useful Knowledge. And in general, that's the kind of knowledge that he thought one should aim at. So that his interests in science were indelible, really, because of his curiosity. He was so interested in everything around him that he wanted to find out more about everything. And this frequently resulted in some pretty important, what we would call scientific discoveries. The discovery that lightning was electricity. The discovery that electricity comes in both positive and negative charges. That some substances conduct electricity and others do not. And some conduct it better than others. And so on. Though in those observations, he laid the foundation of electrical science, of pure science. But he gave it up. Everybody begged him to continue, but he was more interested in being useful in other ways. I think he underestimated the importance of useless knowledge. The way in which useless knowledge can become useful. As the knowledge that there are negative and positive charges of electricity was important in his discovering the use of lightning rods. I think he probably thought that his study of electricity was more important for lightning rods than for the theoretical concepts that became the basis of the science.
And, of course, it's the science that becomes, at least initially in his lifetime, the basis for his worldwide reputation. He's
absolutely
hailed as a scientist. And I was struck by the fact that you quote Thomas Jefferson, no less a person than he, advising Franklin to give up the public life, give up politics, and concentrate on the scientific work. No one else
yes.
could do it as well as he.
Jefferson really believed in useless knowledge in a way that Franklin didn't, I think. And it's a marked difference between the two men, both of whom have a kind of curiosity about the world, which they try to satisfy. But Franklin thought that public service was more important than useless knowledge. But the fact is that his fame as an electrical experimenter, which made him such a figure throughout Europe, became an important element in his diplomatic achievements. People all over Europe respected Franklin. He was the only American who had a worldwide reputation, I would say.
I'm struck by something that you emphasized in your book. Franklin is clearly an ambitious and even a vain person, and yet his strategy for becoming famous, becoming a prominent man, is to not make it appear that he wants any of that. He doesn't respond to people who criticize him. He's often silent in public debates. He shies away from polemics. Could you discuss that strategy a little bit more? Why did he want to stay away from disagreements?
Well, you know, he wanted to stay away from disagreements that were futile, in which class he would put religious disputes. But he didn't stay away from political disputes. He spent his life before the Declaration of Independence in political disputes, in trying to persuade England and the English ministry to get some sense in their heads and realize the importance of America to the British Empire and the need to avoid antagonizing American opinion. He believed that opinion really is the basis of all government, a view that he shared with David Hume. So that any government that wanted to succeed had to win the good opinion of the people it was trying to govern. If you lost that opinion, force alone would not enable you to govern. You had to win opinion. And he did his best for 10 years, from 1764 to 75, to change British opinions about the way they should govern America. He was unsuccessful. And finally, in 1775, gave up. By the time he left England for America, he knew that war and independence were inevitable because the British just could not see what they were doing.
It took him a while to get to that point, interestingly enough. He's representing Americans in Great Britain during time of great turmoil, and yet initially, as you note, he supports the Stamp Act, he objects to the Boston Tea Party, he even wants to avoid for a long time talking in terms of natural rights, as other people do.
That's true, and I think he did underestimate the importance of American attachment to rights. Rights were something in Franklin's mind that were important only because people believed in them. And he miscalculated how much Americans believed in the right not to be taxed and the right to hold property without any interference from a British government in which they were not represented. But his main interest until the British made it impossible to pursue that vein any longer was to preserve and magnify the British Empire, realizing that America was going to be the most important part of it. He foresaw the future of America as the strength of the British Empire, that eventually Americans would overtake the British in power and population. It would be not unlikely that the center of the empire would move to America.
Your conclusion about Benjamin Franklin is an interesting and yet paradoxical one, I think. You write that Franklin did as much as any other man ever has to shape the world in which he and others lived, and yet that world that resulted was not quite the world that he would have wanted to make. He helps to shape the world. I mean, it's not the world he would have chosen had he been able to choose. Could you expand on that, please?
Yes, I think that Franklin did shape the world he lived in. To begin with, he shaped the society around him in Philadelphia. We have to remember that the first 50 years of his life, he's in Philadelphia. He's not a world figure. And that is very important to him, to shape that society. Later, his most important accomplishment in shaping the world he lived in was to get French recognition of American independence and French support of it. He was the international beggar, I guess, going to France and getting the money that sustained the United States as a going enterprise. Even for 2 years after the war, he's getting letters from the Secretary of Finance at the Continental Congress saying, even if there's a peace, we can't go on without more money from France, so on. So the difference, contradiction between that and what I say about it's not the kind of world he wanted, is that he was ready always to serve the public, to do what the public wanted, even if it was not what he wanted. And what he wanted was not to gain assistance from France. It was for the United States to go it alone, in without outside help. And he said as much, apparently, in the Continental Congress, that he didn't want a French alliance, but he was the only person who could get it, and Congress wanted it, and they sent him, and he got it, because he was probably the only person in the United States who could have. But the kind of government that he would have liked to see at the Constitutional Convention, for example, where his presence was very important in making the convention acceptable and workable for the people of America who respected him so much by then, but he would not have had the Constitution that we have. He would have had no Senate. He would have had a unicameral legislature elected by the people entirely without property qualifications. He would have had a perhaps no president, but an executive council, and they would have had no veto power. He was the most democratic of all the founding fathers, but he didn't get his way. He would have liked also to limit the amount of money that any public servant could earn. He was simply a far more democratic than any of the others.
A great man whose greatness comes in part, I suppose, from his recognition that he's one of many.
Yes.
Well, Professor Morgan, it's been a pleasure speaking with you today.
Well, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. I can seldom stop talking about Benjamin Franklin once I get started.
People will have to turn to the book. And that book is Benjamin Franklin. The author with whom I've been speaking is Edmund S. Morgan.
Continuing our focus on Benjamin Franklin, but in a quite different manner, we take up the question posed by filmmaker Ronald Blumer. How do you make a history series for television dealing with a period before photography? Blumer has written and or co-produced 60 documentary films over the years, including the three-part PBS series Benjamin Franklin.
Here's the problem. How do you make a history series for television dealing with a period before photography? What do you show? I've worked on, in one capacity or another, several dozen television documentaries having historical subjects, ranging from a series on Lyndon Johnson to a film about the stock market crash of 1929. Each film has its own set of problems to be solved, but the dilemma of trying to bring alive pre-photographic history on television is always a big one. There are, alas, only a few ways of slicing the sausage. You can attempt the expensive and delicate business of recreation, or you can use images symbolically, falling leaves, pans across open fields and sunsets, and the like. Of course, both techniques only go so far. Several years ago, I was asked to write a series on the subject of the American Revolution. As I pored through the written material, I got more and more excited about the way in which the Revolution was experienced by people who actually lived through it. Now, we can't go back and interview Washington or Jefferson or the common soldier, but we do have their thoughts recorded in letters, diary entries, and pamphlets. I came up with the idea of having on-camera actors appear as if they were being interviewed, saying essentially the same words that they wrote. Here from our series Liberty is the actor John Seymour Hoffman as Joseph Plum Martin, a soldier in the American Revolution who wrote an account of his adventures.
You know, they put me in this regiment, half New Englanders and half Pennsylvanians. These folks is different as night and day. And myself, I'd rather be fighting with a tribe of Indians than with these Southerners. I mean, the foreigners can hardly speak English. They don't like me either. And they call me that damn Yankee. That's about the nicest thing they say.
This is a very difficult technique. As with all film, we're creating an illusion. But if the audience becomes aware of the illusion, of the fact that they're watching someone just acting in a drama, then the spell is broken. The trick is to find very experienced actors who can make the words believable. We use this technique again in our series on Benjamin Franklin, with the actor Richard Easton. Easton has classical training and a half a century of experience on the stage. In front of our camera, he seemed to transform himself into the character.
It is the inclination of old men to talk about themselves and their deeds. But just because I'm old, don't feel you owe me any respect. You can listen or not, as you please. I confess right off, because if I deny it, you won't believe me, that another reason I'm talking about myself is to gratify my own vanity. By the way, have you ever noticed when someone is making a speech which they introduce with the words, "Without vanity, I may say," they always say something very vain about themselves right afterwards? Some people think vanity is an evil. I don't. I think vanity is one of the great comforts of life.
At the beginning of Program 2 of this series, we tell the fascinating story of Franklin's attempt to negotiate with Thomas Penn in 1758. Franklin, representing the Pennsylvania Assembly, is trying to get the proprietor to pay more money for the expenses of running the province. Here's an excerpt from that scene, with Richard Easton playing Franklin and Simon Jones playing the arrogant William Penn.
I answered that, according to his father's charter, which founded Pennsylvania, and then I quoted it to him, the Assembly of Pennsylvania shall have all the power and privileges of any assembly formed by freeborn subjects of England. Aha! He says, but my father didn't have any authority from the crown to grant this right. And then he laughs, snorting like a donkey. I was astounded.
He's a vile liar. That's not what I said or did. The rights of freeborn Englishmen. The Germans settled Pennsylvania because there was good farmland there. They'd never even heard of my father's charter. In any case, it's over. I'll have no further conversations, for any reason whatsoever, with this tribune of the people.
Thomas is enraged. When I meet him anywhere, he looks at me with a strange mixture of hatred, anger, fear, and vexation. I've absolutely no regrets for calling him a swindler. That description is completely justified. I hope it sticks in his liver.
Obviously, actors are crucial in the production of this sort of television history. But scholars are an even more important element. Many filmmakers consider scholars a cross that they must bear in order to produce their works of art. But in every historical film that I've worked on, the on-camera scholars are the real key to the film. The actors and the narration can tell the story, but it's the scholars who provide the context and the understanding. In the scene with Franklin and Penn, David Morgan gives the subtext of what was really going on during that exchange.
Franklin was a self-made man. He had gradually clawed his way up in the world, and he had become a world-famous figure. I suppose Franklin thought he was due a certain amount of respect for what he had accomplished. And Penn probably thought that if you weren't born rich, you didn't deserve respect.
In our films, the scholars are not only the conveyors of information, but they inject their own personalities into the business of telling the story. Take Carol Birkin, who appears in Program 3 of our series. She describes John Adams arriving in France in 1778 to help Franklin in his delicate negotiations with the French.
Nobody could be less suited to be a diplomat in any court in Europe than John Adams. He has no social skills. More to the point, he never wanted to acquire any. Adams comes into the Paris scene as sort of the bull in the china shop. You can just picture Franklin going, "Oh my God, everything I've done here, all the groundwork I've laid, this idiot can destroy in 5 minutes."
Both the teacher and the filmmaker have the challenge of holding the interest of their audience, and television has the potential of reaching millions of viewers. That said, historical documentaries do not have to be about so-called visual subjects such as war, and history does not have to be dumbed down to appeal only to 8-year-olds. Scholars are the secret weapon in an intelligent filmmaker's arsenal. They are, in the end, what gives the show meaning. At the conclusion of the Franklin series, Carol Birkin tells us why Franklin never really got the credit for his extraordinary achievements in France. Her words were quoted in almost every newspaper review of the program. In our 3.5-hour series, this is what people remembered.
It's sort of inexplicable that after all Franklin had done, he was not greeted with laurel wreath and flower petals strewn. I think some of it is because America had found its hero in George Washington. If you immortalize Washington, you say, the Americans who starved at Valley Forge triumphed because God was on our side, truth and justice were on our side. If you immortalize Franklin, then you say, we couldn't have done it without France. And so when you pick your heroes to revere, you're also picking the myth about yourself that you want to tell.
You've been listening to Ronald Bloomer. Bloomer is a filmmaker who has written and or co-produced 60 documentary films, including the PBS series Benjamin Franklin. And that's it for another week of Talking History. We hope you've enjoyed the show. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. Joey Skidmore, producer. Fiona Beatty, assistant producer. You can learn more about the OAH and Talking History at oah.org. Until next week, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.